Welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. Our counsel in the first case, Nittler versus Cook, ready to proceed?
Yes.
You may set up while I make the other announcements. Our counsel and People v. Gilmore, both present and checked in? Have all counsel received a written statement of our procedures? Does any of you have any questions? All right. If anyone in the audience has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off so the attorneys are not interrupted during their argument? That said, we are ready to proceed in Nittler versus Cook.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Suzanne Pariser, registration 36799, representing the appellant Roger Nittler and Company. May it please the court. Roger Nittler and Company provided accounting services to John Cook and his many business enterprises for over 20 years. That relationship ended when Mr. Cook failed to pay his bills. At the trial court, the court found there to be a failure of proof with respect to damages. That finding was clearly erroneous. Roger Nittler presented documentary evidence in the form of ledger books and exhibits showing what damages were due, as well as he testifying as to what damages were due. First, I'm going to discuss why the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous. A trial court is clearly bound to at least estimate damages based on the available evidence. Next, I'll discuss why Mr. Cook's partnerships should be liable on the debts that were due. Again, the trial court found there to be a failure of proof, yet Mr. Nittler did present substantial evidence of what damages were owed by these partnerships.
Well, are you seeking damages against the partnerships or damages or recovery from Mr. Cook based on claims debt of the partnerships?
The recovery is from Mr. Cook. The trial court did find that Mr. Cook would be personally liable on the partnership's debts because that was not covered by the statute of frauds.
Does the partnership have to be named in the lawsuit?
The trial court found that the partnerships did not need to be named in the lawsuits because they were not considered a separate entity.
I was going to ask, is the trial court legally correct on that conclusion?
I believe they are legally correct. An LLC is a separate entity under Colorado law, which I will argue does not necessarily have to be named as a defendant. In this case, the LLCs did not need to be named because the trial court should have pierced those corporate veils to find liability.
Did you specifically plead, or whoever was trial counsel, did trial counsel specifically plead to piercing the corporate veil theory?
Trial counsel did argue piercing the corporate veil.
No, my question was a little more narrow. Was a piercing the corporate veil theory pleaded?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor. The piercing the corporate veil theory came out during the trial when the trial counsel argued that under wastewater and land, the trial court has the ability to pierce the corporate veil instead of having named the LLCs in the complaint.
Did Mr. Cook's counsel object to that as beyond the scope of the pleadings and the trial management order?
No, I don't believe they did.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, a trial court has the duty to find damages even when those damages are difficult to ascertain. At the trial level here, it seemed that the trial court was confused, to say the least, regarding what interest rate Mr. Nittler and Company was charging to Mr. Cook. The trial court found that 18% interest would have been appropriate when Mr. Nittler was sending Mr. Cook invoices. However, the trial court then found that 18% would not have been appropriate after the invoices ceased. Having made those findings, the trial court then found that there was a failure of proof with respect to all damages. Irrespective of what interest rate was being charged, there were principal amounts owed on all of the debts. Mr. Cook had a personal account. The amount owed on that account was a little bit over $15,000. He had the two partnership accounts, The damages owed on those accounts were a little over $6,000 and a bit over $4,000.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, but I'm having a little bit of trouble with your argument about the interest. The trial court could clearly simply have been saying, if there is a principal due, here are the interest figures, 18% before a given date, 8% afterwards. But that does not inherently mean that there is a principal amount due.
I would agree with.
Am I right about
that? I would agree with that.
Okay.
The problem in this case is that the trial court didn't make a record showing what facts they did rely on finding there to be a failure of proof. They simply recited the issue with the interest rate and then found a failure of proof with respect to all damages. The trial court didn't mention principal amounts owed, even though evidence was presented of principal amounts owed. The trial court just simply said there was a failure of proof and awarded Mr. Nittler nothing.
Didn't Mr. Cook testify that he never agreed to pay interest and that if you don't consider interest, then the payments he made on his personal account would leave at most a nominal amount due as of 2006?
I believe what Mr. Cook testified about was that he didn't believe that Mr. Nittler was charging interest after the last invoice in 2003 was sent out. And the trial court did find that Mr. Cook, being an experienced businessman, would have assumed that there was an interest rate being charged, at least during the period where the invoices were being sent out. After the invoices ceased, Mr. Nittler did send Mr. Cook several demand letters for payment. However, even if the court agrees that the 18% stops in 2003, the statutory rate of 8% should apply after that last invoice was sent out. There still would have been an outstanding principal balance on the personal account as well as the two partnership accounts. And I'll argue that the LLCs also had principal amounts owing and they should be liable.
Pardon me again, counsel, but I want to take Judge Webb's question in perhaps another direction. If Mr. Cook testified that absent any interest, I think I've paid off this debt, couldn't that be evidence in the record that would support a finding that there was not any, that there was a failure of proof? I mean, it's a credibility determination, isn't it? And if the trial court believes Mr. Cook that there was nothing due, well, then maybe there is no interest due.
I could agree with that it is the trial court's determination, yet the trial court didn't make it clear that they were relying on credibility at all. There was no mention of, you know, finding Mr. Cook more credible than Mr. Nittler or finding the exhibits less credible than Mr. Cook's testimony. So, you know, a clear review of the trial court record is necessary. I just don't think there were enough findings showing where the trial court got their decision from.
So are you asking us to reverse because there's no evidence that would justify a decision for Mr. Cook, or are you asking us to vacate and remand with direction that the trial court make whatever findings it considers appropriate?
I would ask that the case be remanded to the trial court to make sufficient findings. Of course, I would ask that during that remand, the testimony and documents are re-examined by the trial court.
Okay, but you're not asking for a reversal, outright reversal?
Not necessarily.
What would the remand direct the court to do as it pertains to the personal account?
The remand would ask the trial court to, I guess, examine all of the exhibits and testimony and make clear findings with respect to whether there were principal amount owed with 18% interest until the date of the last invoice. I think it was April of 2003. And then findings with respect to additional interest amounts due at the statutory rate of 8% from 2003 until the present.
Okay, thank you.
I'd also ask that the partnerships be remanded to determine whether the partnerships had outstanding principal amounts and interest payable at that time. Again, the trial court failed to make any findings with respect to the partnerships. The two partnerships were to be personally liable. Mr. Cook was to be personally liable on them, according to the trial court. Yet, in the motion for clarification, the trial court merely stated there's a failure of proof again, but didn't explain where their decision was coming from. Mr. Cook should also be personally liable for the debts that the LLC accumulated to Mr. Knittler. These LLCs were closely held. He was the only member of the LLCs. They were flow-through enterprises, meaning that all the profit and losses were included in Mr. Cook's personal tax returns. The court is able to pierce the corporate veil in this situation. I believe it's a matter of equity in this case to not allow Mr. Cook to perpetrate a fraud. In other words,
well, let's focus up on that a minute, because that's an element of a piercing theory. Where exactly is there evidence that Mr. Cook did anything fraudulent?
Well, I don't believe there's clear evidence of fraud, and I don't think that's an element of piercing the corporate veil necessarily. However, I don't think you can use the corporate form to hide yourself from liability. In other words, you can't open an LLC, incur debts on that LLC's behalf, and then walk away from those debts. It just wouldn't be fair.
Well, isn't that inherent in an LLC by statute, that the members do not have any personal liability? And isn't that a risk you assume when you do business with an LLC or a corporation?
I think depending on the type of LLC, how many members are in the LLC, how the LLC operates, I think those are more important factors to recognize in this case. Like I said, this was a closely held organization, just one member. It was flow-through enterprise. The LLCs were dissolved prior to the case, so there was no corporate form to go after in this case. Mr. Cook should be held liable as the principal on these accounts. In addition, Mr. Cook had always paid the debts of the LLCs, so he showed that throughout the period where the two individuals knew each other that he was liable on the debt. He would pay the debts personally on behalf of the LLCs. The LLCs should also be liable because Mr. Knittler provided services to them, and there was an inherent promise to pay those debts. So I believe that the statute of frauds does not apply in this case. In other words, there doesn't have to be a written agreement for the LLCs for Mr. Cook to pay the debts of the LLCs. I believe the doctrine of part performance could be applied in this case, and it should be applied to find Mr. Cook liable for the debts of the LLC. Thank you.
If it pleases the court, Mike McKinnon, registration number 24689, appearing on behalf of Mr. Cook, who is the appellee in this case. I believe in this case that the trial court correctly weighed the credibility, which is the sole province of the trial court in this specific case. The testimony from Mr. Knittler, which I believe is the dooming factor in Mr. Knittler's case, was originally he set forth for $133,000 in damages. During the trial, then it became $57,000 in damages. Then it became $27,000 in damages. There was eight interest rates that he was seeking from 8% to 18%. Mr. Knittler testified at trial under cross-examination. He admitted that his calculations and the interest calculations were not accurate. In this case, as Judge Webb indicated, is Mr. Cook testified that he had paid everything that was due and owing, and at the end of the trial, the court being the trier of fact and assessing the credibility of the parties, clearly concluded that based upon the testimony of the two individuals, that Mr. Cook was more credible. And what I think was even more astonishing at the trial is even after the close of the evidence, the trial court gave Mr. Nittler another opportunity to try and say, ask him, what is the interest? How much is the interest? When did it accrue from? What was the interest rate that you were charging? And Mr. Nittler still could not answer that specific question. And in this case here, because clearly the damages that Mr. Nittler was seeking, because he couldn't prove an amount of damages, there were, and after the trial, Mr. Nittler came back and filed a motion to clarify. At that point, he was seeking $32,000 in damages. Clearly, all the damages were speculative and based upon conjecture, which clearly case law says are not awardable.
Well, counsel, what do you do with the determination by the trial court that it was that Mr. Cook was an experienced businessman and his testimony that he didn't owe any interest was not credible? When you combine that against the court's finding that there was an agreement for 18% interest.
And again, that was one of the, and I agree the court did look at that, but in the end, had to weigh the credibility as to Mr. Cook saying, I paid everything, and whether interest was due or not, that was for the court to determine. And it concluded in the end, no, in the end, after hearing all the testimony and asking Mr. Nittler on numerous occasions, how much interest, from what date, I think the court then at that point could go ahead and conclude that he had not proven his damages by a preponderance of the evidence.
But did the court make a specific finding that Mr. Cook had paid everything?
There was no specific finding that Mr. Cook had paid everything, but I think by implication, by the fact that the court did enter judgment in favor of Mr. Cook, the court, all that, you know, giving all inferences due to Mr. Cook based upon his testimony, then concluded that everything had been paid. I think that's the only inference that can be drawn in this case. Otherwise, the court would have gone ahead and said, okay, I do find that there is some principal amount, but the problem was Mr. Nittler couldn't even testify to what the principal amount was. When he started out asking for $133,000 under cross-examination, he couldn't testify. What is principal? What is interest? What date did that interest accrue from? And it got down to, as I said in the motion to clarify, he's asking then for $32,000 at 8% interest from a whole new date that was never brought up at the court or at the court trial. So I think the very fact that the court may have, on the record, gone ahead and tried to reason out a little bit of what the testimony was, the court could conclude that based upon Mr. Cook's testimony that everything's been paid, therefore there's no damages proven by Mr. Nittler, and the fact that Mr. Nittler could never come to a dollar figure that he was asking for in damages. So I think given that, and it's, yes, the court is there as the trier of fact, but the court is not there to have to tell a party what their damages are. The party has to tell the court what the damages are and prove by a preponderance of the evidence what the damages are. And if you don't do that, and if they are based upon speculation and they are based upon conjecture, and I can't say that anything other than that occurred in this case, when you go from $133,000 down to $32,000 in one court case, clearly a party can't prove their damages. So the court was correct in going ahead and entering judgment in favor of Mr. Cook. As to the, I disagree with counsel, as to the piercing the corporate veil, from the outset is the minute that Mr. Nittler tried to get into these other entities and these other partnerships, there were objections because they were not named. In fact, pre-trial, as far as disclosures go, I brought that to the attention of the trial court saying that only Mr. Cook had been named as a party, therefore any evidence, and it was in the combination of really a motion in limine, I think a motion under the disclosures that they failed to provide specific disclosures as to these other entities, that evidence would not come in. The court, being a trial of the court, let it come out as, you know, as the trial progressed and then made rulings as we went from there. But I think the court was correct overall and should not have addressed a piercing the corporate veil argument because, number one, it was never pled. Number two, there was an objection to begin with.
Well, let me stop you there. Were you trial counsel?
Yes, I was.
Did you specifically object to the piercing evidence on the basis that it had not been pled nor set forth in the TMO?
As I recall, the best of my recollection is I believe we did interpose an objection at the beginning of the trial, and it may have been at that time when the court ruled I'm going to allow the evidence in. I may not have made a contemporaneous objection at that point, but I believe pre-trial, that was one of the arguments we made, that there should be no ability of them to go ahead and enter any evidence regarding these other entities because only Mr. Cook was named.
Okay, that's a little different from my question. My question was, did you specifically preserve the issue that the piercing evidence should have come in because such a claim had not been pled?
I can't say contemporaneously when it came in. I made that objection.
Okay, thank you.
The other part, the partial performance argument, we've indicated in our brief that we believe that there are several issues that have been raised that were not raised or preserved in the trial court. One of them is the piercing or the part performance. I don't recall that specific issue coming up at all, being addressed in the trial court whatsoever, and I think it's being presented for the first time for review here, which we'd ask the court not to address.
Well, you raised the statute of frauds below. And are you saying that Mr. Knittler's attorneys never brought up the part performance exception to the statute of frauds before the trial court?
As I recall, the argument went that our argument was that since it wasn't in writing,
right,
that it should not be enforced. I believe that at that point, their argument was that this isn't a statute of frauds case to begin with. And they may have I can't say specifically they argued part performance, but as I recall, I don't believe that they got into an in-depth part performance type of statute of frauds analysis. I believe it was more that he agreed to go and answer for these specific debts, and that therefore you don't have to have it in writing, not as a part performance, but just it doesn't come within the statute of frauds as a written agreement to answer for the debt of another. So that's the best of what I recall at the trial court. I think that the court correctly, at the close of the evidence in Mr. Knittler's case, did correctly go ahead and dismiss any claims or any damage, any claims that were related to the LLCs, because I think the statute of frauds clearly applied. Our argument was broader to say it applied to the partnerships as well, because Mr. Cook was being sued individually. So we did make that argument all the way through. The court did allow evidence, I think just to err on the side of caution, did allow evidence during the trial as to some of the partnership evidence. But again, because Mr. Cook's credibility and Mr. Knittler's credibility were the key factors in this case, at the end of the day, it didn't make any difference as to that evidence because the court correctly concluded that there was no damages proven in this case.
So you agree with your counterpart that the trial court found that for at least two of the entities, there was a partnership, and that Mr. Cook was responsible personally for those partnerships, but then you disagree that there was a finding as to the damages.
I would agree that in the end, the court alluded to that there was Mr. Cook, and Mr. Cook potentially had some responsibility in the end for some of that if they prove damages, he could have been in the end ultimately responsible for those damages proven. But again, because they didn't prove the damages and couldn't prove it, and the first time I believe that there was any attempt for them to make an argument as to what amounts were owed was in after the fact was the motion to clarify, and it wasn't even a motion under CRCP 58 or 59, and they vehemently said, no, we're not asking the court to amend its findings or anything like that. We're just asking you to now enter judgment in our favor, but I think it was never presented at the trial as far as actual damages.
If we separate interest from principal, did Mr. Knittler admit that his ledgers were inaccurate as to principal?
I believe during the trial he did admit that his calculations, which was, the ledgers were the calculations, were inaccurate.
Okay, but does that include the interest uncertainty?
That include interest, it included principal and interest, but principal basically, because his ledgers were based upon, or his damage calculations that he tried to were based upon the ledgers, which he admitted were inaccurate.
Thank you.
In this case, I think it is axiomatic to say that the trial court is in the best position, that absent, competent evidence and a clearly erroneous judgment entered by the court, we'd ask the court to go ahead and uphold that because, again, it was Mr. Nittler's burden to prove his damages, and as you can see from the transcript, Mr. Nittler didn't get anywhere close to proving his damages, and the court weighed the credibility and in the end found that Mr. Cook was more credible, I believe, in the end than Mr. Nittler was. Thank you.
Your Honors, if it was a matter of credibility, the trial court should have said so. The trial court didn't make any mention of credibility at their ruling. In other words, they didn't find that Mr. Cook's testimony was more credible than Mr. Nittler's testimony. The trial court didn't find that the ledgers were not accurate. The trial court was simply, may I say, confused about what was the appropriate interest rate. And I think that was the real issue in this case, was that Mr. Nittler couldn't clearly articulate what the exact interest rate was. The other issue was, on the stand, explaining to the trial court what the different interest rate calculations would have been prior to 2003 and then after 2003.
So on remand, if we accept your argument, should we direct the trial court to make findings on credibility?
Yes, the trial court should make findings on credibility. There should be at least a reasoned basis for coming to the conclusion that there was a failure of proof in this case. Considering that Mr. Nittler testified about different damage scenarios, given the 18% interest versus the 8% interest, as well as providing the court with a whole binder of documentary evidence, yes, there should be some findings on credibility. Mathematical certainty isn't required, and the courts have made it clear that if there's at least a showing of damages, the trial court does have a duty to go through the record, go through the exhibits, and at least attempt to calculate what damages were. If the court didn't believe that there was an agreement for 18% interest, then the 8% interest should have applied to the outstanding amounts. As far as the part performance issue not being raised at the trial court, I believe that there was some allusion, at least, to the exception to the statute of frauds. No attorney at trial is going to know exactly what their arguments or positions will be at a future appeal. So I believe we preserved the right to appeal on those grounds because we at least alluded to that argument. The notice of appeal was sufficiently broad to put Mr. Cook and counsel on notice that these were the issues that we were going to be arguing about at appeal.
Your time is exhausted. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused, and counsel in our next case,